Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Here's David Frum in The Atlantic. For me, the thought of my own death has never been a distressing subject. We live, we love, we yield the stage to our children. I hoped that when the time arrived, I would have the chance for farewells. If that wish were granted, I could, with total content, ride the train to my final destination. It never occurred to me that one of my children might board the train first, pulling away as her parents wept on the platform. Okay, I don't mind telling you, this is probably going to be the hardest interview that I've ever done, just because you and I have known each other for a long time, and in order to sort of deal with the subject of grief, I'm going to have to ask you a bunch of questions I don't think I normally would, away from the cameras. So let's see how we do. How did you find out about Miranda's death?
It was about 20 to 11 on the morning of Friday, February 16th. I was preparing, as I so often am, for a podcast, in this case with Tim Miller of The Bulwark. We were to start at 11. And about 20 minutes before that, I received a text from my youngest daughter, who's studying a semester abroad, that one of Miranda's friends was trying urgently to get in touch with me. And so I called that friend back. And the friend shared the news that Miranda had been found, and the friend was very humane in the way she told the story. She said Miranda had someone came into clean her apartment once a week. The person had come in that morning, had found Miranda. She wasn't breathing. She called 911, and I said, "Has she been taken to the hospital?" And the friend had to then say, "No, Miranda's dead. She had died in the night before." When the brain tumor that Miranda suffered from had done, although it was caught and removed, it was not a cancerous brain tumor. It was non-cancerous, but there's no such thing as a benign brain tumor. It was aggressive and advanced and had done a lot of damage to the glands of her brain, leaving her with a permanently depleted endocrine system. And your hormones regulate your whole body. They thirst, sleep, response to infection. And so she was vulnerable, and she was a person who loved life. She was not going to live as an invalid. She tried to live as a healthy person, as a normal person. And the two facts of the depleted immune and endocrine system, and her determination to live life to the full, they met at about 3 a.m. on February 16th of this year.
Do you have any idea whether she knew she was dying?
I do know that in the 6 or 8 weeks before, she made a special point of visiting in person everyone in the world she loved in many, many different cities. She was always a footloose kind of person, but she went to New York, she went to Los Angeles, she went to Toronto. I don't think she was consciously saying goodbye, but it was like she was doing a last tour of this world she loved so well, and she loved her. You know, the thing about, among the many things one might say about Miranda, she had this gift for making profoundly intimate friends extraordinarily quickly. And one of the stories about Ringo, she was walking Ringo in a park in Lower Manhattan, and there was an older man who with a sketchbook, and he made a sketch of Ringo and presented it to her. And he was slightly above the age where this was a flirtatious move, although who knows. So she got into conversation with him. It turns out he was an extremely well-known artist who's exhibited at all the major New York museums, has works in the permanent collection. He was a veteran of the Israeli army in the war of 1973. And they became intimate friends. And she would visit with him and all because he had sketched Ringo. So she had people like that all over the world. And I think she bade them farewell.
To get us started, Sheldon, our director, I wonder if you would bring up these graphics so we can share some of these disturbing numbers. StatsCan has a report out on this. It's quite alarming. If we look at a map of the province, and I'll go through this for those listening on podcast and can't see the map, these numbers become very concerning for Ontarians. The Canadian Centre to End Human Trafficking launched a hotline service in 2019 that reveals 67% of Canadian human trafficking incidents reported to the hotline from the years 2019 to 22 occurred here in the province of Ontario. Two-thirds. Following Ontario, the closest numbers are 10% in Alberta, 9% in BC, and 7% in Quebec. But Ontario stands out for all the wrong reasons. Cassandra, react to that if you would.
Thank you for bringing this topic up to your audience. This stat is a stat that has been ongoing for a lot of years. As we've woken up to the issue of human trafficking, I do want to say that we've woken up to the issue of human trafficking, but now we're becoming aware of numbers that have really always existed, right? Mm-hmm. So what I do find is that the stat that you've provided does indicate that Ontario, unfortunately, has a huge amount of sex trafficking here in our province. At the same time, we do know that it's still the tip of the iceberg.
Well, let me pick up on that with Gary. Why Ontario? It's a real outlier if you look at that national map.
I would agree, and I would agree with what Cassandra was saying, that there's so much awareness out there now, and Ontario is doing so much, with not just the police services, obviously biased, but the ministry, the community partners, they're doing so much in Ontario. And not to say that's not happening in other provinces, but we are, I think we're at the forefront, honestly, in the country right now.
Why would our numbers be so much bigger than everybody else's, though?
I would imagine population, a lot of urban environments, a lot of urban cities here in the province.
Yeah, but that was two-thirds of everything in the country. Well, let me put it this way. We are accustomed in Ontario to being 40% of everything because we're 40% of the population of the country. Yeah. Our number's a lot bigger than 40. So what explains that?
I think it's a lot to do with that. I think it's a lot of the awareness. I think people are coming forward more. And I also agree with what Cassandra said in that it's always been there. It's that people are coming out more. Victims are coming forward at a bigger pace, a lot faster, a lot more willing to come forward to police, to community partners, like we have on the panel here.
Well, that takes me to you, because you know all about this for a number of different reasons. Why don't you give us some of your background as how you came to this issue?
Yeah, for sure. So in terms of my work, the way that I came into it was really through an academic lens, actually, where I studied gender-based violence. And then I began to understand how can we actually trickle that down and what does that translate to in person. And so when it comes to human trafficking here in Ontario, as Cassandra mentioned, this is only scratching the tip of the iceberg. And when we're talking about the tip of the iceberg, Victim Services Toronto supports about 400 people just last year. And when we're comparing that to the stats for across Canada was less than 4,000 cases from 2012 to 2022. And so that averages out to about 400 cases a year. And so because we're looking at police-reported statistics, oftentimes we're still not seeing the full picture. Mm-hmm. And I think what's really important in that, and the reason behind that, is really twofold. I think one is the criminal justice system. Oftentimes people don't feel comfortable coming forward. They may not feel comfortable reporting. Of course, there have been some improvements in terms of that comfort coming forward. And then, of course, there's the re-traumatization in the court process. So many people, you know, they may, feel afraid if they're coming forward and they're actually sharing within the court process, some of the most harrowing experiences of their life with absolute strangers. And so there's that. And then the second reason, which is not the criminal justice system, it's the relational aspect of human trafficking.
What does that mean?
So over 90% of people who are being trafficked are trafficked by somebody that they know. And StatsCan said that over 30% of people who are being trafficked by an intimate partner. So that relational aspect where there's a trusting relationship that's built prior to the trafficking, what that oftentimes results in is, fear of what is this person going to do to me. Sometimes, if it's an intimate relationship, there's a paradoxical relationship in which the person thinks, hey, this person actually really loves me and deeply cares for me. So there's that trauma bond. And those things can be very challenging to break away from. So we can even see people exiting a situation and then feeling like they need to go back. So I think those are the major reasons as to why this is really only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the reality of human trafficking.
Arthi, let's start with this. There's a community in your ward that is dealing with some rent eviction or dem eviction, describe it as you like. Lenmore Court in Scarborough. Tell us what's happening there.
Thank you for having me on, Steve. You know, that was, you know, the canary in the coal mine. To the context of my by-election, we saw a rise, a disturbing trend of number of rent evictions, dem evictions that begged the question from all classes, really, who recognize, you know, the need to have mixed income neighborhoods. So in the midst of housing crisis, why does our system allow existing affordable rental housing to become unavailable? And it becomes a question about tenant protections and tenant rights. So that is an example of a growing trend. In the last 5 years, we've seen a 300% increase in rent evictions across Ontario.
Part of the answer to the question you've raised may be in these numbers. Sheldon, can I ask you to bring this graph up? And for those who are listening on podcast, I'm going to read along here. Here's a graph looking at the Greater Toronto Area and when purpose-built rental housing was constructed. And if we take a look at this graph, before 1960, more than 80,000 units. Then over the next 20 years, 1960 to 79, almost a quarter of a million units. And then we're going to look at the next 20-year period, 1980 to 1999, 20,000 units. Fewer than 10% of the previous two decades. And finally, let's get you up to date. The year 2000 to 2022, again, about the same, almost 24,000 units. In other words, in the Greater Toronto Area, where, frankly, most of the tenants of this province live, 87% of the housing intended for rental use was built more than 40 years ago. So, okay, that takes me to you, and I've got a couple of questions here for starters. Would you acknowledge this phenomenon known as rent evictions is happening out there?
Absolutely, Steve.
Okay, we got that on the record. Mm-hmm. How does the age of all of the facilities that we're talking about here influence that?
Yeah, so I think the chart you put up is very, very instructive in that it demonstrates the age of our rental stock, as we've talked about before. And I think that, of course, is a direct correlation to why we're seeing more applications for vacant possession to conduct significant renovations. I think, you know, freezing buildings in time is not realistic. But on the other hand, we have to be able to have a system that is fairer and transparent and addresses things like notice periods, compensation, right to return. I think we have to have a system. We have to acknowledge this is happening. It's going to keep happening more often in more places. So let's have a provincial framework that addresses it.
Let's see if we can learn anything from what they did in British Columbia. And your worship, I'll bring you in at this point here. You have a rent eviction bylaw in New Westminster, BC. It apparently even survived a court challenge and an appeal. So tell me what you were trying to do out there.
Well, much like Parthi, we saw a massive increase in rent evictions in around 2018-2019 period. We have much like I suspect in his ward, we had a lot of that older rental stock, buildings that were built through CMHC support for purpose-built rental back in the 60s and 70s, and they were reaching a stage of life where they were affordable. You know, they were safe buildings, they were comfortable buildings for the people who lived in them, but they were affordable. When we saw groups of what investors would come in and purchase what were these formerly often sort of mom-and-pop operations that had been there for, you know, 20 years, the same owner, purchased by investors, and the investment model was simply rent evict everybody who was living there, do some minor upgrades, a little bit of paint, maybe a cabinet replacement, and then rent it out at a much higher rate. That was their investment model. Mm-hmm. So we saw a need to step in and protect people as people were losing their homes. We're in a city here where rental vacancies have been under 1% for more than a decade. So if you lose that home that you've been in for 20 years, the opportunity of you finding a replacement home at a reasonable rate, you know, if you have a disability, if you have pets, if you have kids, it adds challenges, especially to that. So we felt the need. We needed to step in. We brought in a rent eviction bylaw, which, to Tony's point, did allow significant renovation when they had to happen with rights of return and such things. But I think it stepped in to stop that predatory sort of action of just removing people so that you can rent it out for a higher rate.
And a quick follow-up, is it working?
We think so. We have not had those complaints anymore about that sort of predatory renovation. We do have people occasionally contacting City Hall and saying, I've got a notice under my door. They've got a new owner for the building. We're worried. And we have processes in place in the city for us to actually reach out to the tenants and to reach out to the property owner to find out what their intent is and make sure the property owner knows what their rights are and make sure the tenants, most importantly, know what their rights are.
You write in the introduction to your book, our health systems suffer from arrested development. What does that mean?
Well, it means that we started off really well, way back in the 40s and 50s and 60s of the last generation. We did some really great things. We, Tommy Douglas and others, decided that we should have insurance for everybody so their hospital care would be covered. And then later they decided we should make sure everybody has insurance for doctor care. And that started in Saskatchewan, was affirmed across the country. Monique Bejean did some great work to wrap all that together in 1984.
With the Canada Health Act.
With the Canada Health Act. And then we stopped. Even though those founders of Medicare always dreamed that it would go beyond just doctors that was guaranteed and beyond hospitals, that it would include things like home care and mental health care. But we essentially rested on our laurels and said what we had done was pretty awesome, and it is. So it's not nothing, but it never actually finished developing.
Well, you said one thing in this book, and I thought, don't we already have this? You said universal primary care is something we should have in Canada. And as I say, I thought, wait a sec, we have that, don't we? We don't, eh?
We do not have that. And you're not alone in thinking that we have that because we've always thought, well, everyone can get doctor care, but the reality is everyone can't because, in fact, we know now from studies that have been done in the last year or so measuring access to family doctors that there's about 22% of Canadian adults that don't have a family doctor or any other place to go to get primary care. And it happened almost without us knowing it, like the frog in the pot that gets boiled up until you realize that you're in a bit of a crisis and no one was paying attention.
It's like a bunch of folks my age, a bunch of family docs my age just retired, and suddenly 2 million people in Ontario don't have a family doctor.
Retirement is a big part of it. It's the supply side as well. Mm-hmm. It's people leaving and going into specialized areas, but it's certainly reached a crisis point.
You know, I got to tell you, one of the reasons I really liked your book so much was not just the prescriptive part of it, but also because I've known you since you first got into public. Actually, I met you before you got into public life.
I think so.
But there's a lot in here I didn't know about you, and with your, well, you've written about it, so I'm not going to ask your permission. I'm just going here. How much of your wanting to be a family doctor was because of what happened to your brother, Gary, and maybe you should explain that to people as well?
Well, thank you for asking that, Steve. And I do, it's in the chapter where I talk about being a family doctor that I describe the family doctor of my childhood, the first one I remember, and how he did house calls for us, which was an amazing thing that very few family doctors do anymore. And the reason that really mattered a lot to me and to our family was that we had a very tragic death of my brother, who was just a year or so older than me. He was 6.5 years old. We were living in Winnipeg at the time. There was a big influenza outbreak in Winnipeg, and he became sick one day, and a few days later ended up in Winnipeg Hospital and died within days of his illness coming on. And it was obviously incredibly hard on my mom, especially. And I always felt when our family doctor came over to visit or when we went to see our family doctor that it really mattered a lot to my mom that she knew that there was someone that was looking out for her and looking out for the kids. And so I think that while I didn't realize it at the time and almost didn't realize it until I reflected on it in writing the book, that 2 decades after my brother died, I was a family doctor myself. And I'm sure that what happened to him had more of an impact than I've ever realized.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.